You're listening to a Stranger podcast, www.thestranger.com.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony, well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Podcast.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the podcast. This is Dan Savage. We have a very special guest today, Dr. Brock Gaster, primary care physician at the University of Washington, where he's also on the faculty. Hey, Brock.
Good morning, Dan.
He's joining us to field some of your more picayune medical questions that I can't just fucking vamp my way through. Sometimes people throw out questions that I even have to admit that I'm completely unqualified.
And sometimes you're wrong.
And there are times when I am wrong. And I rely on my listeners to keep me honest, sort of, actually. When have I been wrong in the past?
just here and there, I hear it, and I get upset, and I was like, oh, I better get in there and help Dan out. So here I am.
Sometimes you're wrong, too. You were wrong to agree to answer all those questions in my column over the years about piss drinking before Google came along.
Because now
when you Google your name, you're mostly sort of linked with the consumption of urine.
Yeah. Who knew that Google, the magic of Google would change our lives?
Would come along, and now you're drowning in sea of urine drinking links.
I am.
Google it yourself, Dr. Brock Gaster. You'll see. Your research doesn't come up, just your Savage Love appearances, regret.
If you scroll down to the second or third page, then you get to the actual work that I do.
He suffered so, and he's going to handle your questions so that I don't fuck them up. Here we go.
Bring it on.
Hi, Dan. My name is Sarah, and I was calling because I've been with my partner for a year, but when we were first beginning the relationship, I kissed someone else, and my partner believes that in that year that we've been together, that we've been exchanging this other girl's saliva back and forth. She says that she heard that if you kiss someone else, that other person's saliva can live in your mouth for up to 3 months. And then if you were to kiss a different person, then that saliva could be transferred back and forth. Anyway, I've got to know if this is true or not so that I can tell her not to worry. I think this is absurd that she could think that this could happen for up to a year, but I need to find out for sure.
Oh, right. I think I could have handled this one. I think I could have said, this is what happens when you date the retarded. This is what happens when you date 8-year-old boys.
When you date somebody who has a case of the cooties.
Yeah, a very bad case of the cooties.
Yeah.
Or no brain whatsoever. So, Dr. Brock, I don't want to fuck this up as I fucked up so many other complicated medical issues. Does the saliva of men I kissed 30 years ago still live in my mouth, and does it leap out at other people that I kiss now?
Only if the person that you kissed had cooties.
Is there a test for cooties now?
Yeah. So, you can do, like, PCR DNA analysis to look for cooties, but the reality is...
But that's expensive.
It's expensive, and so I don't recommend it. And, bacteria is all around us, and you know, it's people are so paranoid in irrational ways about sort of germs. And
can't you just fill your mouth with Purell?
Yeah, it's
if you're worried about residual spit from previous relationships.
No, because that's not going to kill all the bacteria in your mouth. You don't want to kill all the bacteria in your mouth. You've got trillions of bacteria.
But this isn't even about
good.
She's not even asking about bacteria. She believes that I guess we have sort of a limited amount of saliva, and that if we get somebody else's saliva in our mouth, it stays there forever, and it gets passed back and forth.
She's talking about germs, and it's silly. And
she's not talking about germs. She's actually talking about saliva.
Yeah, but so saliva does not survive, and it wouldn't sort of keep replicating in her mouth, and she shouldn't worry.
But she shouldn't date this retard anymore. She should get a grown-up girlfriend, right?
She should get a bottle of cooties remover, and everything will be fine.
Hi, Dan. This question is from Dustin. I was wondering if it is possible to freeze off human nipple, similar to the same way that you'd freeze off like a wart or something at the doctor. I was kind of thinking about using an air duster. When you turn it upside down, it sprays out like some liquid stuff and gets ridiculously cold. I was wondering, you know, if you actually went about doing that, what kind of, pleasure or pain it might cause, or if the nipple would actually fall off, similar to a wart falling off.
So what's the current state of medical research on upside-down air dusters as sex toys?
Safe. Completely safe.
You can't actually freeze off a nipple?
He would definitely cause a lot of damage, and he would be left with a giant gaping sort of crater.
Bloody scab.
Where his nipple used to be.
Oh, so you can freeze off a nipple like a wart.
But it won't be like a wart, because with the beauty of freezing off a wart is that there's sort of nice, healthy, regular skin under it. So you freeze it off, and the regular skin underneath it can sort of regenerate and be fine. But there is not such... Like the normal healthy skin of that is at the nipple is nipple skin, and if you freeze it off, it's not like normal skin is going to sort of regrow there, and you'll end up with kind of a nasty, ugly looking scar.
So what if you freeze off someone's nipple and you get it in your mouth and then you kiss somebody else? Will they have that person's nipple in their mouth forever?
They'll have cooties forever is what they'll have. But people get their nipples removed all the time surgically. I mean, you can definitely sort of...
I don't think he actually wants to remove his
right.
nipple. He wants to know if...
What does he want?
He wants to know because he's turned a upside-down air dust can... he's turned a can of air duster upside down and sprayed it, and it's very, very cold. And he wants to know if, like, you know, applying ice to someone's nipples is something that people do under doctor's supervision, I hope, at all times. He wants to know if that stuff, that cold stuff that blasts out of there is so cold that the nipple will turn to ice, crack, and fall off.
And it won't fall off. It'll just sort of get really angry and nasty and scarred up.
And fall off.
But it won't fall off like a wart falls off. A wart falls off because there's like healthy skin under it. But a nipple does not have skin under it.
So you say no.
No, don't do that.
Stick to ice cubes and frozen nitrogen.
Use air dusters
and liquid
places.
Nitrogen.
And liquid nitrogen.
For warts.
Don't
not
use
nipples.
It on your nipples. Yes.
The doctor has spoken. That was an easy one, too,
that
wasn't
was.
It?
So, you would have handled that fine.
It felt kind of obvious, like, because it's a bad idea. It just...
Yes.
It's not a sex toy.
It's not a sex toy. No.
Hi, Dan. I was wondering, this is a question for Dr. Barak. I was wondering if you could ask him what the nutritional content would be, if there is any, to menstrual blood. I ask this because I know placenta blood has been used for oral and facial enhancements or for some nutritional value inherent to menstrual blood, to placenta blood rather. So I was wondering if menstrual blood has any, and if there's any harm in your partner ingesting it or yourself ingesting it.
Now, I don't know if placenta is nutritious. I do know that it's a good substitute for shortening in a pie crust. But what about menstrual blood?
Menstrual blood is blood, and blood is nutritious. Lots of people drink cattle blood all over the world and live on it and are healthy. And cattle blood.
See, now, if I was listening at home, I would think, Brock Astor, he just fucked that up. That can't be true. But I'm not an armchair podcaster. Right. I don't sit at home and criticize other people who are doing their podcasts.
And I'm a doctor. I'm supposed to be open-minded. Stuff like this isn't supposed to yuck me out. But drinking menstrual blood is kind of yucky, Dan. And so this is like why I'm always nervous coming on your show. But I think that
we're getting the icky ones out of the way at the top. So it's all smooth work. It's like the roller coaster going up. It's all smooth sailing after this.
It's pretty nutritious and pretty safe, I guess.
Is it safe to ingest blood?
Yeah, for sure, your own blood. You know, I mean, there's like some tiny risks of spreading this blood-borne diseases if you're drinking other people's blood.
It seems high risk for, hepatitis, HIV, cooties.
Yeah.
Once again, cooties.
Yeah, right. I guess I wouldn't call any of them high risk, though, because your stomach is pretty good at... I mean, most diseases that are blood-borne that are sort of present in the blood and transmitted through blood, your mouth and your stomach are pretty good at sort of protecting you from. And so I would say that I would drinking other people's blood would be not a no-risk activity, but a relatively low-ish risk.
But say you're in a long-term monogamous heterosexual relationship.
Blood-drinking relationship.
Not a blood-drinking relationship. Just like going, you know, this comes up. I get questions about this. I know it doesn't come up in doctor land, we here in sex advice line get this question all the time.
Yep.
Going down on your partner during
vampire,
her period.
You're fine. Yes. So, right. Right.
Going you're down, fluid bonded. You don't use condoms. You're relatively certain of each other's health. Is that okay?
It is. Yes. It's good. It's fine. It's more than an okay. It's good. And blood is...
You end up with a big Bozo the Clown mouth, right? You end up looking like Heath Ledger as the Joker.
Blood is safe to drink, aside from, the small risks of spreading infection, blood is safe to drink and probably pretty nutritious just because... it's got a lot of protein and stuff.
Will it live forever in your mouth like someone else's saliva or their frozen off nipples?
Only if they have cooties.
Hi, Dan. This is Madeline. I'm from the Midwest. So throughout my life, I've had issues with depression. I've been on 3 different antidepressants, but now I've found one that works, Effexor, which has crazy side effects, but it's been working for me with pretty much no side effects for the past 4 years. Except I've never had an orgasm. I probably started experimenting sexually, masturbating, etc. in my early teens, which was when I was diagnosed with depression and started going on antidepressants. And I know there are side effects related to it, and I'm not sure if it's just me or if it's the side effects. It could be just me because I was also molested for 8 years. And I haven't gone through trauma counseling for that because I don't want to put my life on hold for 3 months. And I'm at the point where I can say it happened. I'm okay. I'm currently in a relationship with a guy who's great. He'll do anything sexually. He doesn't care that I'm not orgasmic as long as I enjoy intercourse. Except that, it would be nice to have one. It would be nice to know if it's me or if it's something else environmentally that's doing something to me, either past thoughts about being molested or the antidepressant.
All right, there's a lot going on here, and if we apply Occam's razor, the most obvious answer probably is the correct one, and the most obvious answer seems to be this woman has her head in her ass.
Oh, that's so mean.
She was molested for 8 years. She doesn't want to invest 3 months in therapy to eliminate that possibility. But, the most obvious thing is the antidepressants, which typically have a huge impact on people's libidos.
Yeah. I mean, it's so complicated to try to explain and understand what happens with how antidepressants affect sexual function. And did you know, Dan, that people's sexuality is really complicated?
I had no idea, actually.
And so, trying to sort of figure out why is somebody having problems with sexual function is so complicated and so multifactorial.
And everyone always wants to read back and find the one thing, the Holy Grail, say, Eureka, this is it.
Yeah, right.
And there are non-orgasmic young women her age who were not molested and who aren't antidepressants.
Yeah. I mean, so antidepressants definitely can cause problems with sexual function, and it's a combination of somewhat of decreased libido and some part of a problem with the orgasm mechanism. So people have trouble having orgasms or are not able to have orgasm at all sometimes when they're on an antidepressant. But then it gets so complicated because depression causes problems with sexual function too, and so it's so complicated to figure out is the problems that people are having with sexual function because of their antidepressant or because of their depression or because of the many other things that can get in the way of
residual saliva from a past partner, normal
healthy
cooties.
Functioning. So it's so hard to say, and no question that she should start with getting counseling and trying to sort out whether her past troubles are affecting her sexual function now. So the key question is how much of her sexual function problem started once she went on antidepressants versus where was there before. And if they started after she started antidepressants, then she should really sort of work through that with her doctor, because there
and you can recalibrate your dosage. There's a lot of things you can try. People have found that if they switch
antidepressants,
medications, or they take a lower dose, their libido can come roaring back.
Yep. And in this very week's issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association, there's a study about giving Viagra to women who are having sexual dysfunction because of their antidepressant, and it really did look like it was effective. So it really did look
Don't want to step on your toes, but I read that study too. And it said that studies have shown that just giving Viagra to women who aren't on antidepressants doesn't have much of an effect, but giving it to women who are on antidepressants, it kind of worked like gangbusters, which is odd.
It is odd, yeah. And so, I mean, I think that it's a complicated story, such that I wouldn't say it's an absolute slam dunk that this would work for somebody, but I think this is enough of a positive result from a study that it would be worth trying. And it definitely works much better for people who feel like they have a normal libido but are having problems having an orgasm. So people who are, their main problem is libido, then a medicine like Viagra is less likely to help. But if they feel like their libido is great, but they're just having trouble having an orgasm, then I think trying Viagra or other drugs like it would be worth a try.
Do you have any professional relationship with Pfizer?
I don't.
Hey, Dan, this might be a question for your doctor guy or maybe even the science dude if you get him in again. I've already asked a few doctors, and they didn't really know what to say to me. My question is, when a guy's energy level drops and he feels sleepy for a few minutes, like 45 seconds after he shoots a load, what is going on chemically? And is there a way to minimize that energy drop by eating a lot of vegetables or drinking a lot of Gatorade or something? The reason I'm asking is I'm one of those people who's had a shitty immune system since I was a kid, with lots of colds and allergies and ear, nose, and throat stuff. I'm 35 now, and I still get that energy drop for a few minutes after I come, but I've also slowly developed this thing where, like clockwork, 45 seconds after I come, my throat becomes very dehydrated for a few minutes, like the moisture is getting sucked out of it to be used somewhere else in my body or something. My theory is that whatever cum is made of, like not just the protein in the sperm, but the amino acids and citric acids in the seminal fluid, I looked all this up on the internet, it has to be replenished somehow, so the body kicks in and starts to do stuff. And in my case, I feel this temporary dehydration in the throat as things begin to move around. But I have no idea if I'm right, and I've asked doctors, and they just dismissed it by asking me if I shout a lot when I come. And I make noise sometimes, but that's not what this feels like. It's not a hoarse throat from using my vocal cords. It's like an internal sucking of moisture from my throat. I also asked an Eastern homeopathic dude about it, and he said something about the energy system for the gonads being shared with your respiratory system, but it just sounded like he was telling me what I wanted to hear. So I don't know. If your doctor or the science guy could shed some light on what cum is made of and what happens when you lose it from your body, that would be awesome. Oh, and yeah, this friend of mine suggested I should just eat my own cum afterward if I feel like I need to replenish my amino acids or whatever. And I mean, I'm gay, but I'm not a big cum eater, certainly not after I shoot my load. So there's a bit of a paradox there. Thanks a lot.
We don't want to contradict a homeopath, but is there a respiratory testicle connection? Are the lung bones connected to the ball bones? When he has an orgasm, do his balls immediately start sucking the saliva out of his whole body and drying out his throat?
I don't know, Dan.
Why are you here if you don't know the answer to these questions?
Right, I mean,
you're the doctor. You're doctor guy.
Yeah. You know, so the way that I think, the way I would think of this is that the odds that it really has anything to do with the physical loss of the seminal fluid is really, really small. And that, you know...
Go ahead, just say he's an idiot. You were rolling your eyes or listening to the call. Just say, like, all his theories...
The doctor
this
guy
is the theory of evolution here. This is the theory of crackpot.
The doctor guy does not like to denigrate your callers. Yeah. And so what I would say is
I'll take care of that.
Yeah. So, you know, think of an orgasm as like a really, really powerful chemical thing that's happening in your brain. And, you know, it sort of maps onto a lot of the same sort of brain circuitry that that drug use does. You know, that that just like after after drinking a lot or smoking a lot of marijuana, you're going to feel kind of hungover afterwards. So right after an orgasm, you're going to feel kind of like weak and depleted. And that's like a brain chemistry thing. It has nothing to do with the fluids and amino acids and antioxidants or whatever he feels like he's losing.
It's not that hormone that's in turkey that makes you sleepy Thanksgiving that suddenly released all over your body.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this is, you know, so... You know, having an orgasm is being high on life, which is a good thing. And it's going to sort of leave you kind of a little bit hungover for a few minutes afterwards. And it's not a big deal, and there's nothing
can
you can do about
Barry?
It. And go for it.
You're banging away. You're breathing heavily in and out, which could dry your throat out. But when you're aroused, all sorts of, blood and fluids go to all your, what are those tissues called? Mucous membranes, yeah. Which include your mouth and your throat. You produce more saliva. Some people's noses run while they're fucking, and they produce a lot of snot. And then you come, and it's over. It all recedes, and it makes you feel like your throat is dry, compared to what it was a moment ago when you were banging your heart
out. Yeah, I mean, it's a super intense, you know.
Now, if I said that and you were listening at home, would you think, wrong, and you're just too polite to say it?
I'm always polite when I'm here with you, Dan. I've got nothing.
But at home, you just go, wrong, and pound your hands onto the table, right?
Yeah, I mean, so yeah, he's fine, he's healthy, he's normal,
and but he's wrong.
There's nothing that he can do about it.
But if he wants to eat his own load and send us a video, a JPEG, we're happy to review that for him.
Hi, Dan. This is Craig. I'm 27, straight male, and for a long time I've had a problem with premature ejaculation, which has always gotten in the way of me really enjoying sex, and is something that only recently have I really decided to deal with in any sort of way. I've tried a few techniques that have just kind of discouraged me, like trying to masturbate and then squeeze the head, as you see recommended a lot on the always reliable internet. As I say, this has been discouraging and not particularly effective. I don't know if that is effective, then I'm just not giving myself enough of a chance. But anyway, I decided to ask my friendly HMO about this issue because I know there are medical problems that can sometimes be at the root of this kind of thing. And long story short, they put me on Prozac, 20 milligrams of a generic Prozac. And so I just wanted to know what you had to say about that.
Is there anything they want to put you on Prozac for these days? He says he has premature ejaculation, walks in, and he leaves with a Prozac prescription.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a perfectly legitimate, reasonable thing to try because antidepressants, like we've been talking about, definitely can affect your orgasmia. And so
inhibit it, slow it down.
Yeah, slow it down, right. And so it's, you know, so in women it can make you anorgasmic, so unable to have an orgasm. In men it can definitely delay orgasm, which can be a great effect for somebody who has premature ejaculation. And so absolutely worth trying. Not to say he couldn't have some other side effects from the Prozac, in which case it wouldn't work out well for him, but
and the side effects of Prozac include, now studies have shown, blowing your brains out.
No.
There's been some linkage between Prozac consumption.
Discredited linkage. And so maybe...
Don't contradict me on my own show. You can contradict me in your living room at home.
Yeah, I mean...
So that's been discredited?
In a really, really, really tiny group of people who have depression, antidepressants can sort of make you a little bit crazier. And so if you were already sort of contemplating suicide, then maybe there's some small risk that you could actually do it. But on average, if you look at thousands and thousands of people, your odds of committing suicide on antidepressant are lower than if you're depressed and not on an antidepressant.
Okay, so, and this Prozac prescription, being on Prozac for the rest of your life, just to delay orgasm a little bit, is that smart? Is that wise?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be the rest of his life. He can try it out, and if it helps him a lot, then he could keep taking it. He could sort of take it intermittently. If this is a problem that's really affecting the quality of his life a lot, then potentially using Prozac for this is perfectly reasonable. Lots and lots of people are on Prozac for years and decades and the rest of their life, and it helps them a lot, and it's perfectly safe and does not cause any problems.
He says he tried squeezing the head. Would you recommend that he try an upside-down can of air duster that he spray the head instead?
No, I would not recommend that.
Hey, Dan. So I met this girl, and we got along really well, and everything's been going great. And for the first few weeks, every time it seems like we've been walking along, holding hands and everything, and it seems like it'd be appropriate to have a kiss. And she would kind of beg me off. It would become awkward. And so after a few weeks of this, I start to get a little confused and a little frustrated. And until she explained to me that she was infected with HPV 18, which is a cancer-causing strain of the HPV virus, and that she would hate to infect me, and hence anyone else that I were to be with for the rest of my life, and also that she had had a medical procedure shortly after I met her to remove cancerous cells. And so it's a very heavy, thick thing that's going on with her. And I've been trying to be very supportive and all of that with her. But my question is there a future? Is there something that we can do to continue this relationship? Because we're still friends, and the sexual tension is still there. And is there kissing or rubbing or, mutual masturbation or whatever that can happen so we can continue our relationship without, getting anyone sick? Or if this is something where I should keep my hands to myself and just be friends.
Before we get to the specifics of this guy's question, give us the background on HPV really quickly and the different strains.
Okay, so, there's so many different strains of HPV, and it's exciting.
And what is HPV?
So HPV is human papilloma virus. It's the virus that causes both the warts that are on people's hands and bottoms of their feet and warts that are on their genitals, and it can also cause cervical cancer. And so, but it's big, exciting, good news that we've identified a virus that causes cervical cancer, because it means that we can actually prevent the transmission of that virus with a vaccine and do even more to wipe out cervical cancer than we're already doing.
And we have the vaccine now, tested right here in Seattle.
Yep, and it works.
But it's too late for this guy's girlfriend because she's already infected.
Yeah, and so this leads to the really sort of sad, unfortunate side of this great discovery, which is that so many people get diagnosed. They sort of are told that they have HPV, and it sort of throws them into this sort of spiral of sort of fear and depression that is completely unwarranted, because human papilloma viruses are so common. They're, so many people have them. A small fraction of people who have them can go on to develop cervical cancer, but that can be, even if you have HPV, you can be completely prevented from getting cervical cancer, and so it really won't cause you any bad medical problems. And so many people sort of are now sort of walking around thinking of themselves as sick because they've been told that they have HPV, or being told that, they have to be careful because they're contagious. But the reality is that it's really such a minor, tiny thing in people's lives, and just should not be. It should not be causing this kind of distress in people's
lives. Now, when he says she has HPV 18, which is a cancer-causing strain of the virus, people with HPV 18 or any cancer-causing strain of the virus aren't necessarily going to get cancer. Only a small fraction of those people will develop cancer-like symptoms.
Right, and if you know you have HPV 18, and so then you can be sort of regularly screened for development of sort of precancerous lesions, then your risk of getting cancer is really, really close to zero. And your risk of spreading that virus to somebody else is really low, and your risk of, and even if you did spread it to someone else, your risk of that person having any negative medical effects of getting that HPV would be so low. And so so I think she would do really well to talk to her doctor more about this, and then maybe even talk to a counselor about it to try to allay what sounds like a lot of unnecessary
irrational fear. She seems to think she can never be sexually
you
active
call it,
ever
you,
again.
You call it irrational. I call it unnecessary.
Tomato, tomato. I feel like we have to explain to people why you always sound so nervous when you record the show with me, because we actually play strip guest expert with every call. Barack has to remove an item of clothing.
Getting towards the end.
He's got nothing left on. We're going to give him a Brazilian for the next call. The other thing about HPV that seems to complicate all discussions of it is that for reasons we don't understand, or maybe we do now, because maybe there's new research that I haven't read yet, because I don't have a JAMA subscription like you do, the body sometimes clears the virus. People can have HPV at a stage of their life and be free from it at a later stage
of their
life.
Most of the time that happens. That happens most of the time. Yep.
So it would really be sad for this girl to go through life thinking she is a disease pariah and can never be sexually active ever again.
Yes. Yeah. And even right now, like this should not be affecting her sexual life with somebody who she's in a mutual monogamous relationship with. And so I would just really say, not a big deal.
I would second your advice that she get into counseling, because what I think is probably going on is she was sexually active, got a really common STI that there's a lot of misinformation out there about, and is scared of sex now, and is scared of being sexually active, not so much to protect him, but to protect herself. She just kind of wants to, like, wall sex out
yep.
of her life for a while,
which
isn't necessarily a terrible thing to do if you need to create some space for yourself. Maybe she's not ready to be sexually active again, but it's not something she should do forever, and she would do well to speak to a counselor.
Yeah. Yep. So people should get the HPV vaccine, and if they find out that they have a strain of HPV, they should take a deep breath and talk to their doctor about it and not worry.
Now, what about HPV and men? There's been some reports of oral cancers and also anal cancers being related to HPV, and there's discussion of whether or not males should be vaccinated against HPV, because right now the vaccine's only recommended for women, for young girls.
Right, and the odds are really, really high that the vaccine works in men as well. There's studies to test that have not been completed yet, so the FDA has not approved its use in men. And the people who make recommendations about vaccines have not recommended it for men yet. But that's almost certainly going to happen in the next year or two. The vaccine is available, and any doctor can prescribe it for a man, even though it hasn't been FDA approved for that use. And I would recommend that for young men who are sexually active with multiple sexual partners.
And so this guy, maybe he could reassure his girlfriend by being vaccinated himself if he can be tested and shown not to already be infected with
HPV. Absolutely. Money well spent.
Yes, I was calling to suggest, I heard one of your old podcasts, and that I heard a woman talk about how she gets constant urinary tract infections, and I have had that problem myself. I was going to offer this advice. I got sick of that problem as well, being on drugs and all that stuff. So went to a cold doctor, and he shared with me the Chinese acupressure point that you can rub. That's on the outside of your heel, just above your, or it's almost next to your Achilles tendon. Anyway, you can rub it. It probably hurts when you rub it, and that's how you know when you're there. It's right near that knobby bone structure, just below that. Anyway, hope that helps some people. And I haven't had one ever since I started rubbing it, and I just rub it every time of day. And then also your advice about staying clean was right on.
You're a practitioner of Western medicine. Would you like to take this opportunity to piss all over Eastern medicine?
Actually, no, Dan. I think that I think that there is. If you look at all of alternative medicine, I am actually of the view that acupuncture and acupressure have a lot more to them than many other forms of alternative medicine that can be sort of iffy. And whether it's working because of the placebo effect or something more, I don't know, but there have been just tons of studies where people are randomized to get acupuncture or not, and if they get acupuncture, they whatever that was ailing them does get better. And
so is there a relationship between rubbing your Achilles tendon above the heel until it hurts and not getting urinary tract infections?
The knobby point on your ankle. Who knows? I don't know. And, you know, she says that it works.
She also says she started bathing about the same time. Do you think that might have had some relationship to the decrease in her urinary tract infection problems?
Bathing is good.
Bathing's
is
a
good.
Total conspiracy foisted on us by HMOs and Western medicine.
Pharmaceutical industry. Yeah, and so
they're in bed with the liquid soap industry and the shampoo industry. They're just trying to con us into bathing. What we need to do is stop bathing and just rub our feet and our urinary tract infections will dry up.
Yeah, I mean, so this could be all placebo effect. It could be bathing, but for whatever
could be,
for what it's worth.
You're way out there on a limb with that bathing crack.
I salute her for having found something that works for her, and if other people can't find something else that works, then good.
What about spray air dusters and urinary tract infections? If you just clean out your urethra with a little freezing cold blast of air.
What if you burn off your bladder?
Tuck a Prozac in your urethra?
Would it fall off? Would your bladder fall off?
And we'll leave it there. We always enjoy having you on the show. You don't look like you enjoy being on the show. You're in the fetal position with the microphone curled up between your legs by the end of it.
I do it for you and for your listeners, Dan.
All right, well, we're going to leave it there. Thank you, Dr. Brock Gasser, our occasional guest expert and frequent yeller at the podcast when I'm trying to field ineptly medical questions myself. I'd have you on more often if you'd come on. Once a month? Dr. Brock Gasser, primary care doc and a member of the faculty of the University of Washington here in Seattle. If you have medical questions, send them our way and we'll save them up for the next time we can con him into the building. 206-201-2720 is the number if you want to record a question for a future podcast. And you download us every week at thestranger.com/savage. We'll be back at you next week with our installment of the podcast.